Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. HRN is food radio supported by you. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org.
Today's program is brought to you by Korin, a supplier of Japanese chef knives and restaurant supplies. For more information, visit korin.com.
Hello, welcome to Japan Eats. I'm your host, Akiko Tema, a food writer and the director of the New York Japanese Culinary Academy, which promotes a deep understanding of Japanese cuisine in America. We are broadcasting live from Brooklyn, New York. This show is all about Japanese food and food culture. We see sushi every day in the supermarket, but what is beyond sushi? We hear dashi ramen izakaya, but what exactly are they? Japanese food is still a mystery for many people, and I try to demystify it in this program with my good guests. My guest today is Michael Majors, a documentary photographer and journalist who splits his time between New York City and Austin, Texas. Mike joined us in episode 307 and discussed his affection for Japanese culture and how he captures it through his lens, including works of Japanese shokunin artisans. And Mike is a frequent collaborator with the highly acclaimed publisher, Wars and Kingdoms, and served as lead photographer on their award-winning books, Rice Noodle Fish and Great Olive Pig. And by the way, the legendary author and television host, Anthony Bourdain, was a partner and investor of Wars and Kingdoms. So Mike's images are exhibited globally and have appeared in a wide range of digital and print publications, including Time, Smithsonian, Vogue Italia, CNN's Explore Parts Unknown, and the New York Times, to name a few. And he's joining us today to discuss his recent trip to the Hokkaido island of Japan, which is the home of kombu and other treasured seafood. So we'll talk about how different Hokkaido's food culture is from the mainland of Japan, a story of 96-year-old artisan who hand-processes kombu, unique dishes you should absolutely try in Hokkaido, and much, much more. But before we start, Spanish is available on the Heritage Radio Network website, as well as on iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify as a podcast. So please go to iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, whichever you listen to, and subscribe to Japanese. And please write a review. We truly appreciate your feedback. Now, let's start a conversation with Michael Majors. Hello, Mike. Welcome back to the show.
Hey, Akiko, thank you so much for having me back. It's a real pleasure to be here.
Yep. So I'm very excited to hear about your old experience in Hokkaido. So for listeners who have not listened to episode 307, tell us your background, including your close relationship with Japan.
Sure. And I'll try and keep it brief. So my name is Michael Majors. As Akiko mentioned, I am a documentary photographer, and one of the areas that has really drawn me in, and I think has been probably my most frequent port of call outside of the U.S. during the past decade, has been Japan. Originally started working there for a book project called Rice Noodle Fish, which was the first in a series of three books that I worked on with author Matt Goulding, who is a partner in the media company Roads and Kingdoms, and was Anthony Bourdain's business partner. Bourdain was our publisher at HarperCollins for that series. So Rice Noodle Fish, you know, was a deep dive into Japanese food culture, but really through this idea of shokunin, the ethos of a shokunin, someone who really dedicates their life to the refinement of something, right? It's a word that you hear a lot in Jiro Dreams of Sushi, and it extends out across so many things in Japan, from something as simple as the person sweeping the steps on the metro to high-level artisans making ceramics and kimono and katana swords, these sorts of things. So I kind of became obsessed with studying that and documenting that. And it's taken me back to Japan now. This last trip was my 20th visit. Typically, I'm there for 3 or 4 weeks at a time, you know, at least twice a year. And so it's a place that has really shaped my perspective in so many ways, spending time with people who are highly focused on this idea of sort of doing the small things well and the big things take care of themselves when it comes to the development and the creation of mastery and artistry, I think has been highly inspiring to me. And also, I just love to, you know, be there, and it feels like home.
Right. Well, in episode 307, I was very impressed with your curiosity and also unique way to look at almost like cutting to a Japanese society, which is sometimes very difficult to capture, but you did it so well. So I'm a big fan of your work as well. So, okay, so let's talk about your recent trip to Hokkaido. So you visited Hokkaido Island, which is the northern island of Japan near Russia, from September 10th to 18th this year. So I think it was a good time to visit before the weather gets too cold. So first of all, what kind of place is Hokkaido?
It's a great question. I think when people conceptualize Japan, their knowledge for the most part is of Honshu, which is the main island, which, you know, comprises cities like Tokyo and Kyoto and Hiroshima, Kanazawa, the highlights for most people when they travel for the first time to Japan. There are two more islands, the island of Kyushu in the south, right, which is where you have major cities like Fukuoka and Kagoshima. And then you have the northern island, and the northern island of Hokkaido is a relatively new addition to Japan as a country. It was territory of an indigenous group called the Ainu. For much of its existence, the Ainu are of the same sort of descendant of the Inuit-type population that we saw across that kind of land bridge from Alaska, Russia, that entire area along the Aleutians. And it was quite brutally conquered, I think, with, you know, probably not a good idea to sugarcoat that at all. But the island itself is relatively young in terms of its population compared to places like Kyoto, which is an incredibly old city. So I have been going to Hokkaido, and really specifically two cities, Sapporo and then Niseko, Hirafu area, for many years, for over, I don't know, I guess 8 or 9 years now, for two reasons. One, I really love Sapporo. It's just kind of a perfect wintertime city. The atmosphere, the vibe, there's a grittiness to it that you oftentimes may not see in other large Japanese cities that I'm really drawn to visually. The main sort of entertainment area, Susukino, is just alive, and it's so fascinating. And when it's really cold in the dead of winter, and you're kind of popping into these tiny bars and eating, you know, lamb barbecue, jinjisukan, which is kind of a you know, famous dish there, you know, it's just something really attractive to all of that. And the reason I've been going to Niseko, which I think most people may have heard of because it is absolutely famous around the world for skiing and for incredible powder, is I have some really, really wonderful friends there that run one of the most legendary bars in the world. In fact, Rene Redzepi called it his favorite bar in the world. It's called Bar Gyu, and my friends Yuana and Hizashi have always sort of taken care of me. And typically, I'll end up staying with them for the tail end of most of my trips to kind of recover and recuperate and just hang out with friends. So I feel like I know those areas quite well, and you know, that corridor that runs from Sapporo up into Niseko, incredibly beautiful, right? I mean, you can take the train. It's a little two-car train that goes up from Sapporo to Hirafu, Kuchan, Niseko area. And it runs, you know, with the mountains on one side and the ocean on the other side. And you can be there in the dead of winter. It will be snowing, and you'll see guys surfing, you know, as you're kind of rolling up the coast. And it's just a really magical place. So, you know, my experiences in Hokkaido were largely centralized to those areas. You know, obviously, it's a big space, it's a big island. You have, you know, a number of other you know, types of geographies that you can explore. There's some really incredible mountains that aren't Niseko, and, you know, basically Annapurna, which is kind of one of the main ski mountains there in Niseko, that are outside of that. And you do see a lot of trekking there, especially in that late summer, early fall period as well.
Mm, right. So it's a completely different idea of Japanese land because of the sizable free land versus Tokyo or other big cities, like I mentioned. But I think, like you said, Hokkaido is a new addition to Japanese country, like it's country with Japan. It used to be called Gaichi, means foreign land, literally. So yeah, it's a very interesting concept, but you know, Japanese system, once it's integrated, it's really integrated. So there are issues of the native population called Ainu that you mentioned, but in general, it's a really, Japanese people really proud of having Hokkaido because such a beautiful place and also the unique food culture, which you're going to discuss now. So, so before we start, that part of the food culture. So I heard you were part of a tour group when you visited Hokkaido in September. So what kind of a trip or tour was it?
A great question. So the team at Roads and Kingdoms, which, you know, started out as a digital publication, I worked with them for many, many years on projects, you know, ranging from, you know, the 40th anniversary of the military coup in Chile to, you know, following, you know, young surfers in Haiti, right? They covered all sorts of really incredible stories about the intersection of kind of politics and food and travel around the world. They were Anthony Bourdain's, you know, sort of only investment in the digital media world. And he obviously worked very closely with them. He edited a monthly column while he was still alive. And part of that was also the series of books that co-founder Matt Goulding had written that Tony was the publisher on. So over the past couple of years, one of the areas that they have pivoted to is basically creating these travel experiences that leverage a lot of the relationships that they have around the world with chefs and really with this incredible network that they've developed of chefs and journalists. Jose Andres is also involved in the project, I believe, as an investor. And the experience that they're really trying to deliver in these small group tours is kind of like the way like I might travel if I were, you know, doing a deep dive on a particular story, except in much nicer accommodations, right? So you're really able to have these incredibly authentic, local, intimate experiences, but also doing them in, you know, accommodations that are really incredible and having these kind of, you know, end-to-end, small group, very intimate types of, you know, just access that I don't think you would typically get in your average tour experience, or certainly you couldn't get on your own. So that's kind of the setup for this trip. And they will oftentimes have a photographer with them either initially to scout the locations to help, you know, deliver and develop content for marketing, but also oftentimes on that first trip, you know, it's a way to really document the actual story. Again, you know, we're all kind of coming at this as journalists, right? I mean, that's sort of the training that most of the folks that are conceptualizing and creating and leading these tours have. And so that philosophy and that drive to really go deep on something extends across the entire experience. And I think it's something that the clients pick up too. So we had, I think, 5 clients on this trip, tend to keep the groups pretty small. And, you know, for me, it was really to document the itinerary, right? I mean, treat it as I would any other magazine article, in a sense, you know, telling a story around these different experiences in Hokkaido and, you know, Hokkaido proper. And then obviously, as we started to explore a little bit further afield, traveling out to a really, really tiny island off the far northwestern coast of Hokkaido called Nishiri, which is known for this, you know, very highly prized kombu, uni, and a few other sea-based products. Does that sort of answer the question? I know there's probably a whole podcast that you and Nathan Thornburg, who's the, you know, leading this effort at Roads and Kingdoms, could have. But, you know, that I think is kind of the gist of it.
Right. Okay. So this is a small group of people who are seriously obsessed with food culture and the culture of other places on Earth. And they're well traveled and they're very, very serious about where they see what they see. So, right. So, and also the Mishiri Island, compared to what you said, Niseko or Sapporo, they are relatively more southern part of Hokkaido, which is a huge land. But Mishiri is really the top, almost the north, northern part of Hokkaido, which means that not many people can easily visit. And so that means this trip is especially special. So, so you focused on the city and the other, like the coastline of the northern part, the northest part of Hokkaido?
So the trip started in and around Niseko and Hirafu and Yoichi for a couple of reasons. One, we were working very closely with Ioana Morelli, who is really well known throughout the world now, but she runs a bar in Niseko that is really incredible, but has also just been immersed. She's been there 17 years. She's immersed in food culture there, whether it's sake or winemaking or fermentation, whatever it is. Ioana really is an expert. And so she was helping guide and coordinate, right, that first part of the experiences for our travelers. And so we started out in really her backyard at some level. And in fact, we even hosted a lovely barbecue in her actual backyard. But the trip then moved down to Sapporo from there. And from Sapporo, there's really two ways that you can access Rishiri. One is to take a ferry from a small city, town, on the northwestern coast of Hokkaido called Wakanai, which is not exactly the easiest place to get to. The other way to do it is to fly from the local city airport in Sapporo, which is called, I think it's Okadama Airport, if I'm not mistaken. And there's a small prop plane that flies, I think, twice a day to Nishi. And that flight, is going to be heavily dependent on weather. Certainly in the summertime, you have a better shot of making it. Nishiri, once you hit kind of November, December, is a place that kind of hunkers down for the wintertime. Obviously, there's some folks there that do some backcountry skiing and some trekking kind of thing. But most people are not making the trek over in the dead of winter. So those are, that's sort of how the trip unfolded. And, I can talk about some of these things that we're seeing in Hokkaido proper, obviously, as well as dig into, what I thought was truly one of the most incredible experiences that I've had in Japan and visiting Nishiri and really seeing a lot of things that I'd never seen before. And again, this is coming from someone that's spent a lot of time in this place with a lot of really exceptional access over the past decade. So for me to have my mind kind of blown like that was really a special experience.
Okay, so now we get the general idea of how remote the places you visited and also how Hokkaido can be diverse. So we'll take a quick break here, and when we come back, we'll dive into Hokkaido's unique food culture, including kombu and everything Mike witnessed. So please stay with us.
Today's program is brought to you by Korin, a supplier of Japanese chef knives and restaurant supplies. Korin is proud of their Japanese culture and traditions, but they want you to know that their products are not just for Japanese restaurants. Their knives and tableware bring out the best qualities of food from every culture and fit into every restaurant from French to Pan-Asian to American. And that is why they're located in New York City, where people from every country in the world come to eat. Korin's Tribeca showroom is home to the most extensive collection of Japanese chef knives in the world, including Japan. Stop by to view their exquisitely designed tableware and the rarest natural sharpening stones. They have a whole range of knife services from repair and rust removal to reshaping and realigning. Korin is dedicated to this ideal, bringing the highest quality Japanese design to your table so you can experience the unparalleled quality of Japanese craftsmanship in your home or restaurant. For more information, visit korin.com.
Welcome back. You're listening to Japan Eats on Heritage Radio Network, HRN. I'm your host, Aki Katayama, and my guest today is Michael Majors, who is a documentary photographer and journalist based in New York and Austin, Texas. And he recently visited the Hokkaido Island in Japan and discovered its unique food culture. So let's talk about everything you saw, you ate, basically. So first of all, so Rishiri is called motherland of kombu. And kombu is essentially an ingredient of Japanese food. That's the most essential, I could say, one of the most essential, or if not the most essential, because it's the base of dashi stock, which is used to make the vast majority of Japanese dishes. And very importantly, kombu is a huge source of umami, which is the fifth taste after sweet, salty, sour, and bitter. And umami can effectively enhance your flavor experience in your mouth by enhancing sweet salt, sweet and salty, and the kind of mitigates sour and bitter. So it's a key ingredient of Japanese cuisine. And they say 90% to 95% of kombu is harvested and processed in Hokkaido Island only. And they historically, they're shipped to Kyoto and Osaka, where rich people consumed in Edo period and earlier. So Hokkaido is a very notable area's kombu production, and especially Rishiri is one of the best kombu production areas. So so what type of kombu is Rishiri known for?
So you have this very, very elevated flavor profile, as I understand it, from the dashi that is created from Rishiri kombu. It's incredibly clean, and it has a lightness to it. So very, very highly prized in kaiseki cuisine, for example, where, you know, really food is so much more about subtraction than addition, and having a mother broth, right, which is you know, as you described, right, dashi is the base of kind of so much of Japanese cuisine, especially when we're talking about things like kaiseki. And so I think what I saw on the Rishiri, you know, and I wouldn't be able to tell you the exact species of seaweed, but there is a terroir, effectively, from this place. And of course, there are grades of that seaweed. You know, the hand-harvested seaweed, hand-cut seaweed, and what I witnessed was kind of familial groups doing this, right, typically older, seems to be the most highly prized. And, you know, I think that, again, reflects this decades of experience, you know, generations of experience that go into understanding the entire process. Now, I think there are, you know, there is a specific type of kombu you and I have spoken about before, tororu kombu, which I had never seen before outside of Rishiri, which is really a preparation of kombu that very, very finely shreds the seaweed like gossamer strands, you know, almost like cotton candy in terms of its lightness and texture that can then be utilized as a topping. You know, I actually, believe it or not, there is a ramen restaurant in Rishiri that some have said is the best ramen in Japan. And again, like, who knows, right? I mean, that is one of those absolutely unfalsifiable claims, because there's a lot of amazing ramen throughout, you know.
Right.
I would never make that claim myself. But part of what they fall back on is a broth that is heavily driven by local kombu. And then that tororo kombu is a topping for that ramen. So I had never seen that before. And that was, you know, just incredible balance of flavor, right? Like a classic shoyu style ramen, but clean and light, and with this depth of umami that was so well balanced. It's just really beautiful, right? Totally unexpected. So I think that what you are really picking up, and I suspect that this goes for the uni as well, which is also incredibly
high. Can I just stop there before? So kombu, basically, I like the Rishiri kombu. I mean, there are like many species, but top three, they say makombu, rouse kombu, Rishiri kombu. And like you said, Rishiri kombu is slightly harder than makombu, And I mean, all three, these are the highest quality. And but Vichy kombu tend to be slightly saltier and cleaner. So kaiseki chefs like that clean color because it doesn't compete with other vegetables and other ingredients color. And the makombu, of course, that's another kind of sweeter and softer version of kombu. And the laos kombu, they are kind of more umami containing. So the point here is not, it's like a grape or any kind of thing. You have a nuance based on which species or variety of kombu you pick. But I think Irishiri is such a well-known and picked and processed in very cold area of Hokkaido, which is coldest of cold of Japan. It has a very unique flavors. And also the tororo kombu you mentioned. So basically, tororo is just, you know, the kombu is very hard, dried seaweed. But before all those techniques of preservation was developed, the outside of kombu used to be a little moldy. So people decided to just shave off outside. And what's remaining is inside. And then if you shave it, it's almost like a fluffy, kind of very fine, like misty kind of texture. And you put it in a liquid, it gets so viscous. And it's like a umami bomb. I think that's what you taste in the ramen, because it's a whole concentrated version of kombu. It's already ready to explode the umami in the soup. So that's amazing. And also, you said the 96-year-old craftsman was shaving kombu. Is that something?
Yeah. And I think that, again, well, one of the things that I've seen a lot in islands in Japan, whether it's Sado or, you know, even heading down to places like Yakushima, is that you do have a sort of a concentration of older folks that are sort of keeping some traditions alive. And Rishiri is no different. There are, you know, numerous people that have been, you know, for decades basically doing the same thing. And this one shokunin that we spent some time with, Susumu Akimitsu, that was his name, 96 years old, had been working in this, you know, at making tororo kombu since he was, you know, 11, 12, basically his family business. His son also, you know, involved in it now. But the, you know, there's a really interesting, like when you kind of hand harvest this stuff, you're not diving so much down into the water, as I understand it. They make these like viewing portals for looking under the water without dropping your head in. I actually saw these at a hardware store in the Rishiri by the ferry port, believe it or not. But it's sort of like a bucket, and there's glass on one end of it, and then the other end you can plop down into the ocean, and you can hold this between your teeth. There's sort of a bar that goes across. You can hold it between your teeth and look down and kind of identify where this kombu is and how, you know, how mature it is, whether it's ready to be harvested, et cetera, et cetera. So these guys also have these like insanely developed jaws, from what I saw, I think from holding these things in their teeth. So again, I'd have to explore this a little bit further, because, you know, I had this one experience with one shokunin, and from what I've been told, you know, this is something that is, you know, common, but a small group on the island, in that everyone kind of has their own technique. I did speak with some chefs, you know, in Tokyo, folks that are, you know, running very high-end restaurants, and everyone sort of has their connection in Rishiri to get this stuff. So, you know, it's very, very clear that, you know, it is really at the top of the food chain comes to the quality level of kombu. And I really like, it's exactly as you said, that is the sense of terroir. It's funny. I actually like tried a little bit of seawater, and the seawater even tastes kind of like the kombu, like the uni. Like it's just perfectly concentrated in its salty balance. I can't describe it. It was really remarkable. It really was as if you were tasting the differences in a grape varietal or something like that. that you use to make wine.
Right. So, but it's funny that you mentioned that how kombu is harvested. And one thing we should know about kombu is very hard to farm, because natural wild kombu goes from bottom to upward. And for farming, it goes to the other direction of the gravity. And with all those quality-oriented kombu production, you have to make it wild. And then harvesting is hard because you have to process everything under the sun, from harvesting, kind of drying, and then cutting, and then eventually packing up after grading. The grading comes after that. So it's a very difficult, labor-intensive process, and you need the luck of the sunshine as well. So this is really just not the umami-rich seaweed. It's a very, very difficult work of art. And so that's the, to prove it, the grading system you mentioned earlier is just ridiculously strict, and it's done the third party of the kombu producers. And it's commonly inspected by color, shininess, weight, thickness, width, dryness, shape, damage level, and amount of white powder on the surface, which is actually good. And it's really strict. And then we reflected on the price, you can see in other part of the city, in Tokyo, or Kyoto, Osaka. So just the point of discussing kombu, it's really a work of pride of workers and families. Usually it's a very small family-based operations or like small industrial units of operation only in Hokkaido. So I'm so glad, Mike, that you witnessed all those things, and especially that 96-year-old man. It's like an amazing existence to represent how kombu production is important for Japanese culture, and people historically rely on people like this 96-year-old craftsman. So, yeah. And then, by the way, did you capture those pictures, and can we see it somewhere?
Yes, I did capture them. I'm not exactly sure where they're going to go just yet, but I can definitely send you a couple to see it. And that goes, you know, for sort of uni harvesting as well, and some of these groups that were doing exactly as you say, right? Basically laying out kombu on the side of the road to let it dry in the sun, cutting it, and then it does get, you know, it gets dried and then boxed. The boxes are tied with different colored ribbon representing the grade, and then that determines, you know, the price, and, you know, they are shipped off to the mainland, essentially. And, you know, as you say, there are these kind of co-ops that kind of manage those, aggregating that up to the warehouse level and then sending it out to the various distributors and buyers on Honshu. So, you know, I think that there, for me, there's definitely more to explore in Rishiri. I would like to see more of these processes. And I think your point, which is really exceptionally well taken, is that these are not processes that can be automated or mass produced. So, you know, even though you have someone who is 96 years old who's still doing this, in order for it to continue to maintain a high level of concentration and placement in Japanese food culture, there have to be people that take it over, you know, from that previous generation and keep doing it, because it is just simply not something that's going to be done by a machine.
Right. And then the highest grade kombu is shipped to Kyoto, Osaka, and then top kaiseki restaurants have allocation. And it's very hard to have a new restaurant to have that allocation, because restaurants themselves are, you know, like generations old. So that's how kombu production permeates into Japanese food culture in kaiseki and other very important, you know, establishments. So there used to be a ship called the Kombu Road, and was shipped from Hokkaido to Kyoto on the side of Japan Sea side, because it's the corridor water than going through the Pacific Ocean. So there's a huge history. You can probably find, listeners can find some literatures to learn about it, because it's such an interesting history. And one time I visited one big merchant who just import from Hokkaido, the kombu import, and then allocate to Kyoto. And I visited their warehouse. They had the kombu that's aged for 28 years. So there's a huge thing you can discover. Kombu, it's not just a food item. It's just the whole Japanese history itself. So anyways, so let's talk more about what you started to mention, because I was very curious about, you said sea urchin in Hokkaido you tried?
Hokkaido is absolutely known for, I mean, as an island, certainly known for being a great place to harvest sea urchin. Certainly places like the Hakodate Fish Market, for example, are, you know, well known for being able to get amazing product. There is, you know, incredible Toro bluefin tuna season as well in Hokkaido. But, and again, I didn't really understand the significance of this, but this uni that does come from Nishiri is also highly prized. Hard to know from an exchange rate perspective and everything else, but I've heard that a kilogram of this can command really, really high prices, basically. I don't know, like 40,000 yen, something like that. I think I read something in the Japan Times, you know, recently, maybe a year or two ago about this. So, you know, it is highly prized. The season is relatively short. It kind of runs, I think, you know, July through August, June through August, kind of a thing. So early September is still a good time to be there. You don't really know when the uni harvest is going to come in. So I think we were incredibly fortunate as a group, especially when you have clients with you, that we landed, around 4:35 a.m. that the harvest is coming in, whether it's been successful or not. And so we were able to essentially land around 8:15 in the morning and go straight to, you know, a small hut where the sea urchin were being cut open and, you know, prepared and boxed, basically to go right back on a plane and head down to Tokyo. So, yeah, so this is, you know, it's about as fresh as it gets. I personally am an uni fanatic. I love it. So I was absolutely in heaven having these, you know, these massive, because the actual meat on the sea urchin was quite large, right? I mean, you see varying sizes depending on the origin of the sea urchin, but the meat on this, I think long spine, that you had in the Nishiri was just gigantic. And the flavor was as pure, a blast of like getting hit by an ocean wave as you can imagine. And I think what also really blew me away is how many different preparations of uni I saw while I was eating at various places around the Nishiri. So it wasn't just like, oh, here we have some great raw uni like you might have at a great sushi restaurant, but other preparations as well, cooked in various forms, prepared in various forms, that just gave me a different respect for the ingredient. And also, again, looking at folks who, you know, this is how they live. This is what they've been eating and consuming when it is in season, you know, as much as possible.
Mm, right. So the I think in throughout Japan, you can capture sea urchin. But I think the one you saw in Hokkaido, I think it's the main species, Kitamurasaki uni and also Ezobahu uni. And you got lucky to be able to see that orange, sparkling orange uni. I'm getting hungry now. So, yeah, and it's a really a different food environment because Hokkaido is much colder. And also, I mean, I'm sure you saw salmon and ikura from Hokkaido. Is that something you experienced as well?
Yes, many times. And in fact, I'll say the ikura that I had in Nishiri was the best ikura I have ever had. Again, incredibly mild, I think cured for 24 hours in the preparation that I had, I believe. So lightly cured, right? Which is not uncommon to help take some of that intense flavor out of it to mellow that out. But you know, absolutely incredible in terms of size and texture and flavor. It really is a concentration of incredibly important ingredients to Japanese cuisine in this one really, really small place. And there's not even that many places to eat on the island, right? There's kind of like one main izakaya and, you know, a couple of other places, right? So it's not as if, it's not a place where you would necessarily go to restaurant crawl. But the ingredients themselves are so good that they really just stand on their own. That's, you know, it's really, for me, again, like it sort of takes a lot to move the needle in Japan, right? I feel like I've seen a lot. I was really blown away. I probably have used that phrase ad nauseum at this point, talking to people about it. But I'm an evangelist now for Yahudi. Like, go, experience it. It is a place that will shift your perspective.
Interesting, right? I think it's interesting that that's a preserved nature, but climate change doesn't stop anywhere on Earth. So I heard that climate change is affecting the nature of Hokkaido, including the city. So what's happening as a result of warming temperature and other climate changes on the island?
It's a great question, and it's obviously one that I think many regions around the world that have a focus on agriculture are struggling with. So obviously, you know, we hear about the impact of this on growing grapes in Champagne, for example, and other regions of France. What I think is perhaps, you know, not necessarily unique, but certainly interesting in Hokkaido in particular, is Hokkaido has been the breadbasket of Japan for many years, right? It is the home to most of the dairy production. There is a deep industrial, industrial is not the right word, but there's an industry around food that gets exported to other parts of Japan in mass, right? What you've started to see as temperatures have climbed in Hokkaido is other products that weren't necessarily viable 20 or 30 years ago are starting to benefit from this incredibly rich volcanic soil and a lot of arable land, which is what Hokkaido has compared to other parts of Japan, which are incredibly densely populated. So one place that we see that is with rice. Hokkaido now has the ability to produce some local rice, and there are also some local sake producers as well. They're taking advantage of this, which is just, I don't think would have been possible, again, at least as I understand it, you know, a few decades ago. Mm-hmm. The other industry that seems to be more viable now than maybe a few decades ago is the wine business. In Yoichi, which is not far from the Niseko Hidafu area, sort of between that area and Sapporo, is really becoming the home for wine in Hokkaido. You're starting to see some really, really incredible expressions, again, of local terroir there. So Domaine Takahiko is one of them. Really interesting producer, only doing Pinot Noir, right? And, you know, I think that one of the questions that comes up oftentimes is you're doing a Burgundian sort of grape in a place that gets a lot more rain than Burgundy every year, right? And, you know, how do you work around those things? How do you, you know, what type of terroir are you creating? Because, again, this grape is very sensitive to that. And what I think that this particular winemaker has done is specifically try to create a wine that actually has a lot of umami in it, which is not something that you typically hear from winemakers. And, you know, I've had a chance to sample some of these wines. You know, they were poured at the Noma pop-up in Kyoto in April, and then I had a chance to taste, to barrel taste with him on this last trip in September, which is really, really an honor. And so much of that comes down to Ioana Morelli and her, you know, just connections and knowledge throughout that region. But what you're hearing from these folks is that these slight shifts in climate are having, you know, some fairly big impacts And as that continues, right, because, you know, these ripple effects only grow, they would expect these areas to, you know, perhaps be a bit more forgiving for growing grapes than they might have been. So I think that's probably the single biggest impact that I've seen and heard about. And we don't really know, you know, what that looks like longer term, obviously. Mm-hmm. So, and right. I, you know, for Nishiri, sorry, just to take it back to the beginning of your question, for Nishiri, you're still pretty far north and the sea temperatures are still pretty cold. So I didn't hear anyone mention sort of specifically a factor around climate change or global warming as they did, you know, in more southern parts of Hokkaido. Mm. But again, I think it largely depends on, you know, how we are able to, you know, manage and keep some of these, you know, more dire potential outcomes in check. Because obviously so much of the bounty of that island is driven by the seawater temperature itself.
Mm, right. Well, that is really interesting. Like, good things happening thanks to the warming temperature, but also, I mean, like you said, it's all balance is the key. That's the whole ecosystem that's been lasting for centuries. So hopefully everything's going to work well in the long run. So, but it is exciting. You discovered so many different things and, you know, Japan very well, deeply through your multiple visits and network of friends there. So what's your impression of Hokkaido compared to other parts of Japan, such as Tokyo, Osaka, Kyushu, Kanazawa, and so forth? And also, did you find a different mindset among Hokkaido people?
It's a really interesting question, right? Because, you know, Hokkaido does have a different feel to it. And some of that comes from places like Niseko, which have over the past 10 or 15, 20 years really changed due to the amount of international attention and investment and the development of resort communities there that, you know, people are traveling from all over the world to experience this incredible powder and incredible skiing. And so obviously that, you know, has an influence that changes everything from architecture to cuisine to, you know, just the more international population that might be there year round. I also think though that Sapporo to me is just a different city than places like Kyoto, for example. It's a younger city in terms of its, you know, actual age. And, you know, you see that in the architecture, you see that in the way that it's a city that very clearly has to deal with a cold winter, right? There's a lot of sort of sheltered arcades and ways that you can move through the city without getting pounded with snow and rain and stay relatively warm. You definitely have the influence of, you know, the incredible ability to access seafood, also the ability to access things like Hokkaido lamb, right? I mean, which is one of the reasons why Jingisukan, this Genghis Khan, right? Sort of style Mongolian barbecue. It's a little bit Korean. It's a little bit Mongolian. There's kimchi with it, that kind of thing. You know, it's a very local delicacy, right? At some level. I personally enjoy going out and eating and drinking in Sapporo, you know, in the same way that I sort of enjoy going out and eating and drinking in Osaka. It's a lot less formal. It's a lot more boisterous in some ways. There's a lot, it just feels less, I don't know. I mean, maybe less formal is the right way to describe it. I mean, I'll tell you like just an anecdote. Last night that, you know, we had our group together in Sapporo, we took everyone out for Jingisukan because it is something you have to do when you're there. And, you know, we'd gone through this incredible spread of like every form of the lamb you can get to, and we're pretty full. There's a table next to us, you know, mom, dad, daughter, family, that had also completely overordered, and they had, you know, all of the things that we didn't order actually on their plates. And just like we started talking to them, and immediately they're, you know, throwing food at us, right? And that kind of thing would be like, I've seen that in Osaka, but I haven't seen that in Tokyo, right? And I definitely haven't seen it in Kyoto, where suddenly, you know, we're integrated with a group where we have a language barrier, right? We're having these two different sort of separate experiences, and yet suddenly we're sharing food. So I have always felt that real sense of conviviality in Sapporo in a way that, you know, may not always happen in places that are a little bit more rigid like Tokyo and Kyoto. I say Osaka because I just feel like Osaka is a place that also operates with less rigidity. But again, it's a personal experience, right? And I certainly can't guarantee that would be replicated, but I've had so many great nights out in that town that I really love it. I think that there is a sense that if the big city isn't right for you, right, that you can do something really cool up in Hokkaido. You can still get land. You can do something that's a little bit different. You can be closer to the land in a way that you really couldn't do in Tokyo. So I suspect that that's also some of the draw as well. And the wonderful thing, like everywhere else in Japan, is it's so easy to get to. I'm always surprised. I have a wonderful friend in Japan who is in her late 70s now and has been just an incredible supporter and skeleton key for craftspeople, you know, just incredibly connected in the world of shokunin. And I saw her for lunch as I was leaving town, you know, 4 weeks ago or so. And she said, you know, I've never been to Hokkaido. And, you know, it's not uncommon that you might have someone who just has never traveled up there. And I just, you know, I always say just go, because it is, you know, it's incredibly diverse. The product is incredible. The vibe, the energy of places like Sapporo is just amazing. And when you throw in the bounty of a place like Nishiri, if food is something that drives that curiosity that you want to explore, it will expand your mind.
Right. I think you convinced at least some of our listeners to go to Hokkaido anytime, sometime soon. What are your plans? Are you planning to go back to Hokkaido again sometime?
Always. Yeah, it's definitely, you know, it's one of those places where it's on my itinerary almost every trip. I think there's only been a few occasions that I haven't been able to make it up. I do really want to go back to Nishiri next summer. We're sort of at the point in the year where, you know, getting there gets harder. The atmosphere, the cold, the snow, all those kinds of things starts to play into things. And there's, you know, less to do, you know, from a kind of a harvesting perspective, right? And we're out of the Umi harvest. Not really sure what happens with Kombu as it gets cold. I suspect it gets harder. Same for fishing probably as well. But I think next summer, the plan would be to go for probably a week and really dig in. I'd like to see the process of harvesting kombu kind of from the first step on through the last. I've seen probably the middle section now, but I need to go back and see the first. And I also just think there are folks that are keeping some really important culinary traditions alive. I feel like oftentimes we are so focused on the output of a lot of these products, right? So we're focused on the dashi. We're focused on, you know, the beautiful piece of sushi on our plate, right? Or the ikura on our, you know, on our rice. That understanding where these things come from and the skills and process that it takes to get, you know, from the ocean to our plate is also really worthy of documentation, especially when it comes to folks that have been doing the same thing for 75 or 80 or 85 years. I mean, that to me is just really special. And it's something that I reflect on when I'm sitting down at that beautiful table and eating that beautiful piece of fish or having that beautiful dashi broth, right? I want to be able to understand, you know, how it got there.
Right. So, well, keep watching, keep recording and share all the stories with us again. So where can we find your updates online and on social media?
So I tend to use social media more when I'm working than when I'm not working. I mean, and part of that obviously is wanting to share things in real time to give people a glimpse into what we're doing. And so my Instagram is MPMAGERS. And then obviously if I have, you know, publications or anything else coming out, it tends to get, you know, tend to post it there. My website is the same, MPMAGERS.com. And I am always, you know, looking to push the boundaries here and expand my horizons and experience as many of these really unique looks at, you know, pulling the curtain back on food and craft anywhere I can. So I'm just really happy to get the opportunity to do it and looking forward to the next one.
Mm, right. So come back and talk all about whatever you find. So, yeah.
So, well, I appreciate that. And I appreciate, you know, your curiosity and interest and generosity in having me on. And it's a great dialogue because I always learn a lot as well. And it helps me inform, you know, my understanding.
Mm, right. So you're doing what we cannot do. Our listeners, me, cannot do. So, yeah, so good luck, and we'll hope to have you back again soon. So thanks so much for joining us today, Mike.
Wonderful. Thank you for having me.
So listeners, if you have any questions or comments about the show or suggestions for short topics or guests, please contact us at japaneats@heritageradionetwork.org or at kyokatema.com. Japan Eats is a weekly program and is always available at heritageradionetwork.org as well as on iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify as a podcast. Engineer is Liam Wara, and thanks for listening. I will see you next week.
Japan Eats is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. Keep in touch at heritageradionetwork.org/subscribe.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Alweli, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries, like why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode. Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.